Attention Austin guitarist, are you in need of setup or repair on your axe? Well, I have the guy for you. That's my friend Jason Swedberg over at J. Scott Luthery. You can find him at J. Scott Luthery on Facebook. Gang, I've been taking my guitars to Jason for over 20 years, and not only does he do the very best job, but he has the fastest service and the best prices in town. Find him at J. Scott Luthery on Facebook or jason.swedberg@gmail.com. Gang, whether it's acoustic or electric, Jason is your guy. Get your guitars fixed. Hey gang, are you a fan of podcasts and Law & Order SVU? Well, I have the show for you. The seminal SVU podcast, Munch My Benson, is the twisted love child of co-hosts Adam Schwitters and Josh Dugan, celebrating the splendid and often wildly inappropriate lunacy found only on Law & Order SVU. Each week, Adam and Josh walk you through a random episode of SVU, all while sharing their smart and hilarious insight. Find Munch My Benson wherever it is you stream your podcast, or go to munchmybenson.com for more info. That's Munch My Benson.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time. How did I get here? And now here is your host, I'm Johnny.
Alright, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week. It's been a good week. We got the first round of the vaccine. Got to go to Bucky's. Sorry, I have an audience today. So I'm just going to go ahead and work that. Don't normally have an audience for anything. I don't even talk fucking face-to-face with anyone anymore. Vaccine, got the vaccine, shoulder hurt. I felt a little dizzy, but I'm overall okay. Took some Advil, had some coffee, ate some food, and getting it back together. Playing another wedding with Skyrocket this weekend, and maybe I'll be half as nervous as I was last time, now that I have at least one shot of the two-shot vaccine. I wonder how much the half vaccine, do you know, has anyone ever told you how much the vaccine, half a vaccine protects? No? Okay. Not at all.
I'm reading about it right now.
You're what?
I'm reading about it.
What are they saying about this vaccine?
I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay. Just let me know when you're ready to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Gang, I have a great show for you today. Ruri Joseph from William the Conqueror, a band in the UK, they're a trio in the UK. They have a brand new album out called Maverick Thinker. It's out on vinyl, on CD, on all of the, I guess everything but cassette and 8-track. But it's on the mediums that you want. It's on Chrysalis Records. It's produced by Joseph Lorge. And it was recorded at Sound City Studios, the legendary Sound City Studios. The studio in LA where they recorded Rumors, where they recorded Jesse's Girl, where they recorded countless hits. There's a movie about it made by Dave Grohl, directed by Dave Grohl. Fantastic movie. Go out there and watch it. So Ruri and I have a great conversation, man. It turns out we know a couple of the same dudes. And he's a fucking great songwriter, great singer. The band is really cool. And he's a guy that marches to the beat of his own drum. He went at some point to move to London. And we were talking, I can't remember exactly what city he's in, but he's down in the south of England by the coast, enjoying himself, living in a rural. It's Ruri, living rurally. Out there in the south of England by the beach. And anyway, he also has a podcast where he's kind of telling the story of his life that's available. You can find all this stuff on williamtheconqueror.net. That's their website. You can find all of the podcasts, links to the music, ways to buy the album, the vinyl or the CD if that's what your jam is. Great, great fucking songwriter. Great, great conversation. Very quickly, do we have an update on what they say about the one vaccine? Should I be half as nervous as I was last Saturday, this Saturday, or should I be...
You still need to be careful.
No. I'm not saying
nervous.
I don't... What?
You still need to be nervous.
How? But less nervous? That's the thing. Isn't there a percentage of nervousness that they say, like, say, once you had one, then say you're 63% less nervous than you were at the last gig you played last week? Guys, Ruri's a fantastic conversation. Great musician, great songwriter, funny, funny guy. And yeah, we have a fantastic conversation. Please enjoy it. This is Ruri Joseph from William the Conqueror. Let's get down.
Mm-hmm. flight to a broken home from your imagination. You had a ticket long before you had a destination. Don't take my word for it. Just say
yeah, not too bad. How are you?
I'm doing good. How do I say your name?
However it comes to mind.
Come on.
It really doesn't matter by this point in my life.
Say
no one's ever got it right. It's meant to be pronounced Rury.
Rury. Okay.
Rury, yeah. Okay. Like Rory with a U, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. That's good. So it's just gonna be
and
you
you're,
today?
You're Johnny, right?
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. Yeah. Perfect.
I have that problem with my last name, Gaudi. It's Goudie, and I've always been like Goody and Goody.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Even people that might like try and think it's European, and they'll be like, "Oh, hey, Mr. Goudie," because I live in Austin.
Uh-huh.
Hey, speaking
How's
of that,
things, yeah, go on.
Just real quick. Speaking of that, have you guys been here?
No, we've never been to Austin. We've been to Nashville a couple of times,
yeah.
But that's as close as we've ever got to Austin. Love to go.
Yeah, I know that people listening to this that might not know who you are from here, because that's where I live, I think they're going to freak out on your band.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Your band's incredible, and you're just an amazing songwriter, man.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind, Johnny. Thank
yeah,
you.
Seriously. Yeah. I was
right on.
I was very stoked. I got the info from your publicist. And it took me a couple of days, but when I went to go listen to it, I was like, where are these guys from? Because you really do, there's an Americana quality to you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's just from the influences I had growing up, and it was all American stuff, so it's just kind of seeped in, I suppose.
Right. What part of England are you in?
So right now I live in a place called Cornwall, which is in the very, very southwest. It's like the very, very bottom southwest little corner of England. Been here for about 20 years now, I suppose.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Nice. But beautiful. Yeah, very
is
cool.
There...
It's cut off enough that you can kind of do your own thing creatively. You've got nobody looking over your shoulder down here, which is nice. You know, I've done that thing of living in London, but it's just too much networking going on there. I like the space.
Yeah, that's a good choice you made. But also, like, then how do you your band is based there in Cornwall?
Well, kind of. When we first got together, we all lived down here. Now the drummer lives in Bristol, which is about 3.5 hours north, and the bass player Naomi lives another hour south down in Hale. So we haven't seen much of each other over lockdown, obviously. But when we first started, we all lived in Cornwall, so it was much easier to kind of get together, and that's how it all started. But, you know, it's okay.
Is there like a scene in Cornwall? Like a music scene? Like, how did you guys meet?
Yeah. There's enough of a scene that we've met. It sort of comes in waves because... there's a couple of music colleges down here. So there's Truro College and there's Falmouth College that have good music programs. So what will happen is you'll get an influx of new students coming down to study music, and then the scene will explode because there'll be all these new bands. But the problem is, because we're kind of cut off from the rest of the island, if you want to take it seriously, if you actually, you know, want to make a go of it, making a living out of music, it's hard to do from down here. So what tends to happen is you have this big influx of a scene and all these new bands, and then they'll all kind of move away as they finish college, and they'll go to Brighton or London or Bristol or Manchester, and then we kind of dip and there's no scene again, and then we kind of rise up. You know, it's a strange one, but I kind of like it for that. You know, I've been very lucky to be able to maintain a career from down here, because I think it's quite rare. But
what kind of gigs do you play there? Like, if before you, like, what, yeah, what kind of shows do you do? Or did you do before?
At the beginning, it was pubs, just playing in bars and nightclubs. I mean, anything that was going, really.
Can I ask you?
You have a lot of sun. Yeah, of course.
I don't want to interrupt you, but real quick. Mm. When you're playing these pubs and these nightclubs and shit, you oftentimes you'll get a gig that's longer than your repertoire is, so then you have to throw in covers, or even worse, you have a guy or a lady that owns the place that's like, hey, man, We're going to have to hear the Cars or Mumford and Sons or something. And to be honest, your voice and your delivery is so unique unto itself. I don't really want to hear you sing someone else's songs.
Good, because I can't. That's a good job.
That was the question.
I was quite militant in the beginning. So, I mean, we're talking like, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago now when I first started playing on the scene. I was kind of like that, you know, because I'm baritone, so I can't do covers anyway unless people want Leonard Cohen or The Doors. That's kind of it.
Yeah.
So I went about making a point of making sure I wrote as many songs as I could so that I always had enough to fill out the sets. Because, yeah, down when you first start, it's the sort of minimum requirement is that you play 2 45-minute sets, you know, so you're looking at an hour and a half of music.
Right.
So I just wrote and wrote and wrote until I had enough to do it on my own anyway without having to do covers. And it didn't help. It wasn't that easy to get gigs to begin with, but I stuck to my guns and was just like, you know, I sort of refused to play the covers game because a lot of bands fall into that trap and that's what they end up doing, you know, playing weddings and taking requests. And that was just never my thing. So I ignored that and always tried to keep ahead of the game by just writing all the time, you know?
Dude, I have to tell you that is palpable in your music. Like, I listened to your music and I knew you were a guy that was like, you do it your way, you know what I mean? Like, you're doing your thing, and that's fucking amazing.
Yeah. Oh, good, man.
It's hard to do that.
It is, but I suppose that, you know, I've been lucky in that I don't know how to do anything else. It's quite fortunate, really.
So, man, this album, Maverick Thinker, is fantastic, but this podcast air after it already comes out, but it comes out this Friday. Who is this guy, Joseph Lorge? Is that how you say it? Lorge? Or
Joseph, yeah, Joseph Lorge. He's an engineer, producer based in LA. He is great. I mean, he does a lot of work with Blake Mills. He works at Sound City, so he's done all sorts, man. He's just a cool guy that we happened upon and became friends and had a very, very similar understanding of what we wanted the record to sound like. And it was easy. It was a really easy album to record. I mean, it must have been easy because we got cut short because of the lockdown, but we'd finished anyway, pretty much. You know, we had a couple of things left, but we kind of wrapped up in plenty of time just because it flowed so well, you know?
Right.
It was nice. Serendipitous, yeah.
It's you guys.
Interestingly, he was. Sorry,
no,
go on.
No, no, you please. Go ahead.
I was only going to say a point of note with Joseph is that he was engineer on Bob Dylan's last record, which was the coolest thing about him.
He did that super long song.
Yeah. He was funny because he told us we were set to go to the studio in like the beginning, first 2 weeks of March, and then around Christmas time. This is like back in 2019. We got a call saying, we're really sorry, but we're going to have to postpone you guys by a couple of weeks. But they wouldn't tell us why. And then eventually I managed to badger Joseph enough for him to tell me why we couldn't go. And it was because Bob Dylan was going in there making his new record. It was like, you know, fair enough. I'd have insisted that we moved if that was your opportunity. You know, what a cool thing to do. So he came straight off making Bob Dylan's record and coming in to work with us. So...
no pressure,
very
man.
Cool.
So I have a few questions about this. First of all, I thought when I saw that documentary about Sound City that it was closed, or that just Dave Grohl took their board and they stayed open.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's. I don't know how much I'm supposed to talk about this, but it's not a commercial studio now.
Oh, okay.
It's just owned by the right kind of people that understand what that space means and how precious it is. And so they want to maintain the space, and it's still got, you know, plenty of decent, you know, that particular desk isn't there anymore, but
right.
The two desks that they have got in there are equally as good. I think Led Zeppelin recorded on one of them. And, So it's not commercial in that sense, Sound City. It's just a very cool space that if you happen to be able to find your way in, which we fortunately were, then you're very lucky to be able to use it, I suppose. It's a great space. Amazing.
I never went there. I got to record in a couple of really amazing like historical spaces like Sunset Sound and like these places where you walk in and you're like, oh yeah, that's where you know David Lee Roth or... You know, Jim Morrison or some shit stood.
Mm-hmm.
How Like, what were some of the ghosts that you were looking forward to being in? You know what I mean? Like, who were some of the people that you were like? Like, are you a Tom Petty guy?
Well, not as much as our bass player, Naomi. She's a massive Tom Petty girl, definitely. For me, it was Nevermind was the big one.
Right.
And like I say, walking in there when the seats are still warm from where Bob Dylan was sitting, I think that was pretty cool. But I mean, going back to my youth, you know, Rage Against the Machine, Neil Young's recording there, Fleetwood Mac, obviously, it's huge. But you try not to, me personally, try not to think too much about that stuff when, because you're supposed to be there working, you know, and you've got a finite amount of time to get your stuff done. So I had like, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes when I first arrived of just kind of standing and looking around and trying to take it all in. But you quickly switch into work mode and think, right, if I'm here recording, then I have to just pretend that I'm supposed to be here, you know, instead of worrying about whose shadow you're standing in, you try and make your own impression, I suppose. I don't know if we did that, but we tried.
You know, it's always fucking great being in those magical places because you feel like you're part of it. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, I'm here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Big time. I mean, recording the drums in the same room that Dave Grohl recorded the Nevermind drums in is, of course, it weighs on your mind when you start. But like I say, you, if you don't switch off to that, you're just going to be a nervous wreck for the whole time you're recording there. You have to quickly kind of zone out. And that was a good thing about working with Joseph. You know, he knows the space inside out. So, and he was dead calm. So we just kind of fed off his casual attitude towards it all, you know?
Yeah.
It's cool though. When you have lunch in the foyer or whatever, and you look at all the discs that are framed on the wall and see all the cool records that have been made there, it's hard not to stand in awe sometimes, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you guys went in there. Yeah, the other question that I had was, obviously, I'm going to say I'm 99.8% sure that you recorded that live, like you guys recorded live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. 100%. Okay. Yeah. All of it. Yeah. Yeah.
It would have to be because the it's your sound itself is so organic that I don't think there's really another way to.
No, and we have tried that. We've done that before. Our first album was an album of mostly sort of tracking things because we made it in my garage and only had three microphones. So we physically couldn't record all of us at the same time anyway. So we have done that. And when we do the demo process, that's how we do it, is bit, you know, piecing things together. But there's no substitute for recording live. You never know what nuances are going to come out, or, you know, removing the metronome, removing a click track, just to give you that little bit of freedom to move around. And
that's what you guys did.
I can't believe I avoided it.
You let it breathe.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple where we maybe were like had a metronome to play to because we had a drum sample in there or something, but essentially we're just trying to capture exactly what we do live.
Was that like,
I don't know why
Jesus died a young man. That's like a little,
that had a little loop on the beginning. That's one of those JJ Cale keyboard drum sounds, you know. Yeah, it's a weird one. We had to like cut it out because it was so old, this machine, that if you left it running it would change tempo, like it had a mind of its own. So we had to like record like four bars of perfectly timed drum machine and then just loop that, otherwise it was a no-go. But it's a cool sound though, right?
Yeah it's a really fucking cool sound. So what was the other thing? I was just about to ask something, but then that drum machine thing threw me. I love drum machines, man. I'm crazy about them. You know, I almost bought this, you know, those Boss ones, you know, like, I Can't Go For That, the Hall & Oates song.
What? I think I know it. Is that the famous, the Japanese one? Is it a Japanese drum machine? The CD, whatever it's called?
It, yeah.
808?
No, it's not the 808. It precedes the 808, but it is a Roland or a Boss product, and it has those rainbow buttons, like in the 70s and early 80s. Cool. Their thing was kind of rainbowy, but it only has like 10 beats on it, and one of them is exactly that Hall & Oates song. But I went to go look at one of those things at a very hip synthesizer store. Mm-hmm. Those things are like $1,800.
Really?
Yeah.
Just for the little box.
Yeah.
It's come round again, isn't it? That's the thing, that all that analog stuff that we thought we didn't need anymore when we all turned digital, it's coming back round to it. It's got such a unique sound to it. It's lovely.
Thank you for saying that, because now I remember what I was going to say.
Okay, go.
Going off the grid outside of just following a loop, which is no big deal, but going off the grid is something that's not really done right now. Like, when you listen to music, is it difficult at times? I know it's difficult for me. I'm 52 and I grew up playing rock and roll. Like, I've had bands since I was 14. And and there's something about the grid and how prevalent it is now in the music that you listen to. And it's not even like in the New Order or you know, Depeche Mode kind of way. It's like a real uncool fucking grid. And everything's auto-tuned on a grid, and it's just all like so,
I don't know why that is. I suppose that's the aftermath of everybody being able to make music for themselves. You know, where do you start? You start with the simple things. If you can auto-tune your voice, I have this conversation with my daughter quite a lot, because she sings, and she doesn't need auto-tune. She's got a great voice. But that generation of thinking that to have a great voice means you always sing in tune, you know, like all my favorite singers don't sing in tune. Bob Dylan and Tom Waits or Ian Felice, you know, it's about the character of the voice as opposed to the perfection of it. But I guess that's a harder thing to articulate to the new generation coming through, because they're so used to hearing everything perfectly in tune, which is a strange thing, I suppose. But I don't know. I have this, it's a bit of a dilemma, really, because on the one hand, I think everybody should get into music and everybody has the right to make music and create
and do whatever they want with it.
Obviously, but at the same time, it does, you know, I don't know how to get on with Spotify or Apple Music or any, you know, it's just, I don't know where to begin. I don't know how to start searching for music. There's just too much stuff there, you know. I find myself withdrawing and listening to a lot less music than I used to, definitely, just because I haven't made friends with a way of consuming it so far, you know.
That's interesting.
In the digital age. Yeah. Well, it's kind of sad, but I was a CD generation kid, you know. I was a big fan of the CDs.
Yeah.
And I do like vinyl, but digital, it is amazing. It's amazing if you think of something and you want to find it, or, you know, it is all there. It is incredible, but as a music fan, I'm not comfortable with algorithms being thrown at me to tell me what I should or shouldn't like. It's just not my thing, you know. I haven't found a way in yet. I'm looking forward to it if I can. Not yet. How did we get onto that? Oh, you were talking about the grid. Yeah, going off grid. Yeah.
Yeah, just from the first listen to your album, I felt that. I was like, okay, this guy doesn't give a shit about the.
It's kind of loose, yeah.
Well, that to me,
capturing something. It's not music by numbers, you know. It's like Jackson Pollock style. It's like quite weird. I feel like we're quite an abstract band, even though we might sound quite uniform because we're only a three piece. The abstract nature of it comes in when we're loose, you know, and like part of the thing of not rehearsing for gigs and things and always trying to maintain that adrenaline, some kind of energy that's going to throw something new up every night. That's always been our ethos, really. We don't want to be polished. That was the thing we tried to avoid from the start, you know. I say that as if that, you know, I could just be saying that as an excuse for the fact that we're all a bit loose and lazy, but I mean it, you know. We like the looseness. We like not necessarily knowing how a thing is going to go and dealing with it afterwards, you know?
Well, there's something about the capturing of a performance where recording turns into capturing magic. And that's a thing. Yeah. That's a thing, like carving perfection out ad nauseum is a completely different trip than capturing magic. Yeah. And there is...
Absolutely.
There's something beautiful about, I'm assuming, about the bands that you were inspired to play music from, that there was, you know, there's a thing, you know, just the Stones or, you know, it's like a band like that. Like,
to
the Faces, something, you know, just raw and real.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Waits.
Yeah, Tom Waits is a big one for me. Yeah, it hits a part of my brain that pleases me. I was sort of brainwashed with Bob Dylan growing up.
Me too.
I didn't hear any other music until I was about 11. It was just Bob Dylan and the hymns that we sang at school. I mean that. I'm not exaggerating. So I just thought that's what music was. I thought music was meant to be slightly out of tune and, you know, a little rough around the edges. But it's obviously programmed my brain to kind of always stray towards that method of playing. Richard Thompson said a good thing about how if you're recording live and you polish the edges too much, you'll end up with a lot of notes, but there'll be no music left. You know, all the good stuff is in the edges. You need those rough edges, you know.
Yeah.
I'm all for that. I agree with that.
I'm about that, like with everything, like even people.
Mm.
Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, you're familiar with like Fox News, right?
What kind of
person that they put on there, a female kind of person.
Right.
And it's a person
like
that is...
Like a guest, you mean?
Like a host kind of person. And they're blonde, okay. And they have everything is quote-unquote perfect. I could never...
Sure.
Like, there's no attraction for me to that kind of person. Because just, you can't even, like, feel the edges from them.
It doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel real, does it? It's like being able to put filters on your photographs when you post to Instagram. We're adding to this sort of hyper real world. It's not really a reality. And I guess it's the same with music. And yeah, like you say, the concept of perfection is subjective because to some people it's one thing, to some people it's another. Yeah, the edge is all about the rough edges for me.
Yeah.
Luckily.
Yeah.
I look like this.
So tell me about what kind of songwriter are you? Are you like a daily writer? Are you a disciplined guy that goes to work even when there's nothing?
I go through phases. It depends. I mean, for the William project, as a kid, absolutely. As a kid, songwriting was my hobby. It was just something I did every day. And if I started a song or even just came up with a title for a song, I'd have to finish it. So songwriting was just a thing I did and got used to. And then when I started the William the Conqueror project, so I was a solo musician for about 8 years, kind of on that typical singer-songwriter cycle of make a record, tour it, make another record, tour it. But that didn't really suit me either. So when I started the William Project, I just had, I don't know, something happened to my mind where I opened up a faucet of some kind. And it was all this material that I hadn't really ever thought about from my childhood. And I just had tons and tons to say and tons to write about. So I had a period of, I don't know, maybe a year of writing sort of 3 or 4 albums back to back, thinking that I'd go on and make a trilogy. And that was the original plan. So for a long time, it was all I did. I mean, quite obsessively, I had to actively take a break at a certain point because I was driving myself a bit nuts. But once I'd accrued this big mass of ideas and songs, and some were more complete than others, but once I had it, the analogy I use is like a sculptor. So a sculptor has two options. They can either build up from the ground to build their thing, or they can get a big mass and start chipping away. So by amassing a load of ideas, I was then able to kind of chip away at it and curate the albums out of that. And we ended up separating the trilogy into 3 separate albums as opposed to putting it all out in one. But ever since that big flurry, now I'm still kind of picking away. There's still another, you know, 25 songs on my wall that I'm still chipping away at. So it's not so much a writing thing like, you know, the idea of getting into a room and say, hey, we're going to have a songwriting workshop. That kind of thing doesn't work for me particularly. It's just about instinct. If an idea comes, then I'll just follow it, you know. But I've got no discipline. I've got no strict hourly. It mostly happens at night, but, you know, it can also not happen for long periods of time, and I'm absolutely fine with it. I don't really believe in writer's block. I just think your brain tells you when you need to have a break, you know.
Maverick Thinker is the third of this trilogy of songs?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
oh, awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Maverick Thinker is the our first album was called The Proud Disturber of the Peace, and that was about innocence and childhood. And then our second album was Bleeding on the Soundtrack. That was about disillusionment and more of a kind of adolescent feel to it. The Maverick Thinker is meant to be the mother of those two, and it's much more about faith and trying to put into practice what you've learned over the years. So it was a good album to look forward to, because we, you know, it was hard building from the ground up, which is what we did when we started. We went right from the bottom again. But having that aim, always knowing that, yeah, but if we get through these two, we know we're going to get to make this third album, which is going to be a big release for us, you know, very cathartic experience, which is what it was. It's just a shame we couldn't go out and tour it, you know.
Yeah, that sucks. It's interesting because I listened to those records and I didn't get that picture, obviously, but mm-hmm. I did notice that the Proud Disturber of the Peace, it has a much more innocent sound. I mean, definitely, because there's like a confidence even to your guitar approach and even your tones and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know?
Well, you mean now there is?
Now there is.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Well, that was the thing. And that was where, you know, all the ideas kind of bled into each other. But the idea of innocence was that we didn't know what we were doing. So we had all of these songs and we'd been gigging off the radar in pubs and clubs, but not really advertising. We didn't have a website or any, you know, we weren't actively trying to push the band. We were doing it because we'd forgotten what it was to be in love with music. So we started William to try and remember.
Right.
But when it came to recording in the garage, yeah, we didn't know what we were doing. We recorded about 20 songs in like 3 days and just started to piece this thing together and eventually ended up with, yeah, the first album. But it's meant to sound kind of innocent, like we didn't really know what we were doing. You know, there's lots of different ideas thrown in there, and hopefully the thread is contained within the lyrics, you know, and the stories that we're telling, because they're all about the same kind of thing. But musically, the idea was to flit around and have a vibe, but not necessarily have a strict rule about what could or couldn't go on. So yeah, it was a very innocent time making that record. Yeah,
that's good, man. So let me ask you a question. So when you put out a Bleeding on the Soundtrack, then all of a sudden there was were you guys on a label then?
Yeah, we signed. So we made the first album and it got picked up by a very, very cool indie label called Loose, who I've been a fan of them for ages. They put the Felice Brothers out, which is one of my favorite all-time bands. So we ended up putting it out with them. And it was just a gradual thing, you know, still not really, still kind of finding our feet. I'd been through the record industry as a solo artist, been through, you know, signed to a major label and left them and dropped here and licensed this one and put this one out myself, and I've done all the different ways of putting records out. So starting to get back into the industry side of things after we put the first album out, which all happened quite serendipitously, like I said, we weren't necessarily aiming for it. So come the second one, we were, and it worked with the ethos of what we were trying to do with the albums, because the second one was meant to be about disillusionment and being kind of lost a little bit in, and so that worked with regards to making the record. Luckily we made it with Ethan Johns, who managed to hold us all together.
Oh, really?
And yeah. Which was, again, just a stroke of luck, a real, real good piece of fortune. But yeah, then things started to get serious. You know, when we made a record with Ethan, it was like, okay, we're not doing this off the radar anymore. We seem to be behaving like a band that's actively trying to make a go of it, you know? So it was like, okay, fuck it. Let's have a go at it then and actually take this seriously. So we did, we started taking it seriously. And then the third album, to make in Sound City, it felt like our progression's been kind of well-earned, you know, nothing's been gifted to us. It's been good.
No, you definitely, there's no, you're fucking great. And you should be on an ascension trajectory, you know.
Well, we'll see.
Do you know this guy, the Scottish guy named Colin McLeod?
Yeah, very well. Yeah,
yeah. Colin, he's a good dude. He was here. He was here at South by Southwest a few years ago.
That's
and was
right.
On the show.
Yeah, he was.
And Ethan did his record too, right?
That's right. Yeah. So Colin, funnily enough, was one of the sort of key elements in getting William off, not off the ground, but certainly helping us figure out what we were doing. Because this was back when we were, when William was this thing that we weren't trying to push or tell anyone about, but I was still a solo artist, still, you know, in a position where I should be making records and going out touring, but I was kind of lost with it and didn't necessarily know what to do. Colin was an old friend, and he was setting up a little recording space in his house on the Isle of Lewis.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like the perfect place to go and lose myself for a while. So we headed up there as a band to, I don't really know why, just to record, just to throw some of these ideas around. And we came away with a really good record, which we shelved just because, you know, it was a turning point in us thinking, actually, this, what we've got, what we're onto is actually quite cool. Maybe we should take this seriously. But that was very much down to going and spending some time with Colin, and just where he lives is so cut off from the world.
Yes.
There was nothing around. So it was a perfect little jaunt. We only had 2 days of actual recording because there was a hurricane while we were there that cut the power out across the whole island. So we didn't get much work done, but we had, it was a very philosophical time, you know, a lot of talking about what it all meant and why were we doing this and all that kind of thing. Yeah, Colin's a legend. Got a lot of time for him.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. Yeah, after cool guy. After he did the show, there was something like we ended up emailing each other, and I saw some weird documentary about Donald Trump, and mm-hmm. it ended up his mom. I think his mom was a McLeod from the Upper Hebrides, wherever it is that he lives.
Really?
Right?
Yeah, he's got Scottish connections, hasn't he? Because he made that golf course in Aberdeenshire, didn't he?
Yeah. And so I was telling, I was in Miami visiting my family. My family's Cuban, but there's some Scottish heritage behind there. And
Cool.
And so I was telling somebody like my dad, I was like, yeah, and this guy, you know, out of the blue, I emailed him. Because I think he might be related to Donald Trump's mom, and basically wrote back, and he's like, "Yeah, some level of kinship." And so then my dad was like, "What's his name?" And I'm like, "Oh, Colin McLeod," and he's like, "Well, he's probably related to us because there's McLeods in our family too." So I wrote him back,
and
Colin's response was basically like, "Everybody that has ever been living on this island is related in some way."
Yeah. Island life, yeah.
Totally. Gold. So what kind of touring were you guys doing for Bleeding on the Soundtrack?
We were very much on the I suppose, what would you call it? What would you call the scene we were on? You know, venues, clubs, festival slots, not, you know, capacities of like, I don't know, 200-300 people sometimes, maybe a bit bigger in certain areas, like up to 1,000 down in Cornwall.
But were you opening, doing support for?
We've never really done support tours. Although, actually, having said that, we opened for. Do you know Danny and the Champions of the World?
Uh-uh.
Do you know those guys?
No, but that's a great name.
Great band. We opened for them on a tour. But no, I mean, mainly we would, because there's no money in doing support tours.
No.
They're great fun, and it does, you know, you get put in front of an audience, but there's no money in it. And we are obviously trying to make a living. So we were more active in just trying to establish ourselves with our own circuit. It makes me very sad, actually, talking about the, you know, just thinking of on last year. We started the year we went to Sweden. We did a tour of Sweden. And then we did a tour of Spain, which is easily our best tour so far. Then we were in LA recording the album. You know, everything was just lining up perfectly for us. And absolutely gutting to have it taken away. But we were talking about it today because we've seen each other maybe twice since last March as a band. But once this lockdown's over, we're going to, you know, try and get together and start working on some new stuff and just try and rekindle something. It's sort of forgetting how to play, you know, forgetting how to be a band. We don't rehearse, but we toured enough that we were always kind of evolving, you know, that evolution has kind of just got kind of cut off, but we'll get it back, I'm sure. But,
yeah. Can I ask you this? Because I mm-hmm. had a trio in the 90s for like 2 years, and it the the dynamic and the ability to turn on a dime in that, for some reason, the trio's easier to sort of like jam in if you want to.
Right.
Okay. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. And sort of like things differently. Even like somebody like Dylan, who would play something, I mean, he's an extreme example of it, but but you can change things up in the moment and probably not lose your drummer and bass player. Naomi and Harry.
Absolutely. But Naomi and Harry,
But that seems to be an easier thing to do in a trio. And I've always wondered, is it the sight of vision? Because you have eyes on everyone and everyone can see each other and sort of like, you know what I mean? Turn in a little bit and everyone's able to communicate with their eyes, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, maybe. I think it, you know, it's going to sound like I'm trying to take credit for this. Like they're the solid rhythm section. They're just like, they're the ones keeping me in time 100%. I'm all over the place. But something I try to do with songwriting, because I write the songs with them in mind, is just allowing spaces for those, like you say, the nuances where you get to turn things on a dime or drop things down or pick things up. It's there's definitely something in only being three of you that makes it easier to communicate on stage. But I do think making sure the songs are written with us in mind, as opposed to just like, I'd never kind of sit down and write a song and just say, that's a great song. I wonder if it'll suit the three piece. They're always in my head when I'm writing. So we don't do a lot of jamming, so to speak, but in live situations, that's another thing that gets thrown up, is the surprises when you don't rehearse and get polished. There'll be lots of sections in certain songs where it breaks down or, like you say, dips or gets lifted, and it's a piece of cake to just turn around to Harry and Nay and signal somehow that we're going to carry on, or this is getting boring, let's change it up or whatever. But everything happens within the constraints of the song. You know, it's like the song is the king in our world, I think. So long as the message of whatever that it is the song's trying to say doesn't get lost in, you know, a load of fret wanking or unnecessary showy drum solos or anything like that, it's everything kind of falls back into whether or not it serves the song. Sometimes that might be a 5-minute interlude where no one seems to be doing anything other than dicking around. But I don't know. It's an instinctive thing, I suppose. But yeah, jamming's never been my strong point. I'm not much of a jammer. Most of William's songs are in open tuning. So I used to, when I was a solo artist, singer-songwriter, acoustic guitar stuff, I went on tour with a guy called John Smith. Do you know John Smith?
Mm-mm.
He's played guitar for everyone, but he plays guitar for Lisa Hannigan and Leanne LaHavers. He's just awesome, an amazing guitar player. And I went on tour with him and I watched him every night, and I was really confused by the fact that we had the same amount of fingers and the same instrument, and yet he was able to do all of these things and I didn't know what was going on. So I sort of realized that, okay, I'm not a virtuoso. I'm absolutely not a virtuoso. I understand songwriting and I understand words and lyrics and storytelling, but I'm not a musician. So with William, I just decided to do something that I hadn't really done before, which was just put it in open tuning and figure out how to tell stories with that. So I've heard David Lynch say, when someone asked him about how he plays guitar, he just says, I put it on my lap and I see if I can make it sing. And that's kind of what I do. I don't know any theory. I don't know any, you know, I'm not dexterous. I can't play you fancy solos or nothing. It's all about feeling, you know, just whether or not the guitar is making the sound I want it to. That's all.
Right. Yeah. That always goes
along. Did I answer your question there? Or?
I think so. that goes along with my philosophy. I don't know if you're a fan of Star Wars, but it wasn't until I was well into my adulthood that I realized that all of my spiritual pursuits involve the creation of music, and that it's all wrapped up in Star Wars. like the Jedi thing, okay. like letting go and trusting your feelings.
Yeah,
not giving in to the dark side. Just like pretty simple stuff. But like that whole let go and trust your feelings thing is something that I believe is what makes music magical.
Absolutely. I think you can tell if somebody's trying to do something to impress somebody else.
Yeah.
I had it. Part of why I wanted to stop being a singer-songwriter was because it had become my job. Like I made a living out of it, but that meant it was very important that I stick to the kind of blueprint of the albums I'd made already. So I couldn't stray too far from the acoustic guitar or the kinds of things I was singing about. It was quite sort of safe songwriting, I suppose. It wasn't bad, but it was, there was no way for me to push myself.
Right.
And when I started William, that was one of the key things, was trying to put anybody else out of my mind. So I wasn't thinking about the fans, and I wasn't thinking about the record label or my manager or my agent or anybody. It was just, well, if there was anybody that I was thinking of, it was my younger self, you know, trying to sort of please my teenage self and make the kind of music that he was into, because I think he'd have been quite disappointed with what I'd become as a creative, you know, this kind of safe, doing it because it's a living kind of guy. Whereas when I was young, I was very, very ambitious and had a lot of big ideas. So William was very much about trying to tune into him and, make amends with how I disappointed him or something like that. <you know. laughs> But it relates to what you're saying in that it was only about the feeling, you know, this person that I was writing the songs for doesn't exist apart from in my head. So it was all about the feeling of what the songs were saying, you know?
Yeah. I listened to part of the first episode of your podcast, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to listen to all of them, but I wanted to keep on going through the music.
Yeah.
What exactly is, are you telling your story from?
It's it's like a meta biography.
Is that what it is?
Well, kind of. I became a dad really young. So I was a stepdad at 17, and I was a dad at 19, and which is fantastic. But it did mean that I didn't have what people normally have, which is their 20s to process their youth. So I'd never really processed what I'd been like as a kid and as a teenager and some of the daft things I'd done and stupid decisions I'd made. It was only kind of reaching the age where my kids had kind of grown up and were reaching the age that I was. I left home at 17. We're reaching that age that these things started to come to me that actually maybe there was some things worth investigating. I might be able to find some, I don't know, something creative out of it and do something. Because I had all this collection of old songbooks from when I was a kid, that just hundreds and hundreds of songs, most of which didn't make any sense, but just occasionally there'd be something where I could really tune into what it was I was trying to say, what I was feeling at that time. So there was just something in there. There was something in there in the idea of having a memory of a past that seemed like a fictional character to me. You know, it was like my youth almost hadn't happened. It'd been such a long time since it had happened that the only way I could construct it was in these kind of fragments and these weird vignettes I had of certain images from my youth. And this, I don't know, a story kind of started to present itself because I was writing songs about it, and the songs would spark off other ideas about other things I hadn't thought about. But a story started to develop that was kind of loosely based on my childhood, but it felt like fiction because it wasn't really me. It was just my interpretation of what it was. And I thought, rather than like talk to my mom or, you know, look up old friends that could help me try and piece things together, I thought it'd be much more fun to just let the weird abstract images that had no timeline whatsoever just kind of flow and see if I could piece them together in a narrative that was different to my childhood, but that had enough of the truth in there that it became something that I could relate to, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So I just started writing the book because I had the story, and next thing you know, it became a novel. So I'd sort of written this novel. If anything, the novel's written, and the podcast, as you say, is spoken from the point of view of a 19-year-old, whereas the songs are written from, like, you know, my 38-year-old self. So they're about the same things, but they're from, one's from an adult's perspective and one's from a child's perspective, and they kind of converge and cross over. And the podcast is me reading the book out in the two different voices, and having the music play underneath. And so it's a kind of mashup of everything that is William the Conqueror, you know, this kind of parallel universe or parallel history that I've created somehow. Yeah. It's, but yeah, man, I'd be stoked if you could listen to it. It's had some nice feedback from it. It was good fun. It was a good thing to do. Good project.
Yeah, that's a cathartic thing. Did you ever go through any therapy or anything? You ever see a therapist?
No. I managed to avoid it. Like, you know, times in my life, I've like definitely thought I could benefit from it, but whenever I come close, I just somehow seem to find a way of being able to pour whatever those anxieties are into the music and into the creativity. And again, you often hear creative people say, I think again, this second David Lynch sighting of the evening, David Lynch saying about counseling, he went to one because he felt like he should. And he said, look, is this going to affect my creativity? And they said it could. And he said, okay, forget it then. And he left. And I think there's something in that, because I'm very fortunate that I have, a creative outlet in music and making videos and writing and stuff. So it just all goes in there. So I've never quite felt like I've needed to go to therapy. If I lost music and art and those things, maybe, but no, I seem to be able to. William is my therapist.
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah. There is the sort of like, I don't think it's the way you lose your creativity. There's a thing. I mean, ultimately it is, but what I think we worry about in those situations is what's really happening is there's a drive to create, mm-hmm. not just like being creative, but the drive and the drive to go forward, the drive to have an ascension into something, to get the fuck away from whatever's trying to pull you back to it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're scared if you get calm that then that drive won't be there anymore. Like, if there's nothing pulling you back, then what are you running to?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a sort of tragedy in the fact that the best work, the best songs or writing, whatever, comes when you're in the worst possible sure. place. There's definitely some conflicts going on there. But I don't know. I, how much can you grumble about that? At least I've got it. At least I've got that outlet. It's it's not a bad thing. I never really realized, I don't think, just how much my songwriting was exactly that. Like I said before about going through these old songbooks, it was coming across songs that were clearly like written about like my dad's illness. Like, my dad was a alcoholic growing up, and I'd find songs about it. I was like 13 years old writing these quite, you know, not brilliant, but somehow profound notions about what it meant, what it was like growing up with an addict in the house. And I'd happen upon these things, and I think that's why the singer-songwriter career started to bug me a little bit, because I didn't really feel like I was writing about anything. I'd written so many songs as a kid. I just could write it. As long as I had like a few good lines in there and things sort of sounded like they were about something, I could kind of get away with it. Put a tune to it and then off you go, record an album in your shed. And I was a folk musician. I didn't really need to push myself too much. But it's incredible really how much you can pour in there. And I'm finding it, you know, you can just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into that pool of resources, because there's always something that's going to be bothering you in there. You know, the world is a dark enough place that you'll always find something to write about, you know, if that's your thing.
Yeah. Was that why you left home at 17? Was family stuff?
I don't want to spoil the book for you.
Okay.
No, no, not necessarily. No, we left. I moved to New Zealand with my mum and my brother when I was 14. So I lived in New Zealand for a while, and I left home at 17 and moved back to England on my own with a guitar, sort of thinking that that's I was obviously destined for fame and fortune. But that was my kind of my big plan. But then another set of strange circumstances meant I ended up meeting my future wife when I was 17 and kind of hooking up with her immediately. So I never got to, which is a good thing, because it would have been a disaster had I really tried to pursue that dream. I didn't know what I was doing. I don't know. I've been very lucky that life is kind of always something. Maybe the universe must like me for the time being. It always kind of steers me from making some terrible decisions. I always seem to find my way back onto land somehow. Lucky like that. Yeah.
Are you guys still married?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's 21, awesome.
21 years. Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations. Yeah. That's not very common.
Thank you, man. No, it's not these days.
Anywhere.
It's a bit sad, but no. Yeah. But no, all good. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about who did that video for Quiet Life?
Oh,
in grainy black in and Venice, white. Yeah.
Yeah, on Venice Beach. So, that was funny. So we were in Sound City, and we'd been, I don't know, we had like 4 days left of recording. And a very good old friend of mine, a guy called Luke Kellett, who runs a creative design company in Australia called Head Jam. I told him I was going to Sound City. I said, dude, you have to be there, because he's a great photographer and filmmaker. So I asked him, invited him over for the last 4 days to come and shoot some film and take some pictures of us. As he arrived, he came into the studio in the morning, having just got off a flight, took a few photos, but then was jet lagged. So he fell asleep on the sofa. And when he woke up, it was like, dude, we've got 4 more days. Don't worry. Go home, get some sleep. We'll come back in tomorrow. We'll be fine. But then the next morning we got told that we couldn't go back in because lockdown had come. So poor Luke had flown all the way from Sydney to LA, had like 2 hours to take photographs, and then was told he had to go home.
So
then on the last day, so we changed our flights and we were due to fly out the next evening. So we had one morning where we thought, well, let's go down to Venice Beach and take some shots. And we got there and it was completely deserted. There was no one there because obviously everything had gone into lockdown.
Right.
But Luke had his Super 8 film camera with him. So he just kind of filmed us wandering around these kind of deserted Venice Beach, you know, something like The Walking Dead stuff. And piece that little, it's like a visual poem together for the music video.
It's beautiful, man.
But yeah, it's a really interesting little time capsule because that was the day that we were on our way home and he was on his way home, and we sort of kind of the last time we saw each other, really. So it was probably nice to be able to use it.
Probably felt exactly like it looks.
Yeah. It was kind of scary.
All grainy and drab.
I always kind of think that I'd never been to Venice Beach, but I knew something of it in that it was meant to be this very vibrant place. And, you know, you'd have the homeless community as sort of part of the makeup of the area in some perverse kind of way, a bit like in Amsterdam, like the red light district sort of perverse part of the city, but it's still part of it.
Yeah.
But when we got to Venice Beach, there was only the homeless community there. There was nothing else. So we're just listening to lots of arguments about who had taken the shit on the pavement and where did they get the drugs from. And it was really, really bizarre. It was like the Venice Beach has sort of turned itself inside out just for the time that we were there. And yeah, it was odd, very odd. But yeah, I'm glad to have captured it.
Yeah.
Sure.
How are you guys doing during lockdown? You got...
All right. Bit a bit bored.
Families, yeah.
Family's good, yeah. My wife's a key worker, so she's been working through the whole thing. My kids, my daughter just finished school as lockdown happened, so she's okay. She's on furlough. My youngest is still at school, but we're sort of homeschooling him at the moment. But everybody's kind of, we've been lucky in that respect. And Cornwall in England is very cut off, but it's quite touristy. So we have these periods of time where there's no one around, which makes it feel very safe and all secure. But then in the summer, or anytime the sun comes out, everybody flocks down here for the beaches.
Right.
So you get these kind of waves of panic. But I think generally everybody's been okay. It's just about keeping yourself occupied and trying not to go too crazy. You know, like my mum and dad, they both live on their own. So keeping in touch with them and trying to do what you can to act like this is normal or something.
Yeah.
Not get your hopes up too much. And, you know, I try not to have too many expectations about when gigs are going to come back. Even though I really hope they do, it's like a defense mechanism where in my head, I'm sort of imagining that there's no such thing as in this world that I live in right now, there's no such thing as a gig. It hasn't been invented. So sometime, maybe this year, maybe next year, someone's going to invent this fucking amazing thing called a gig.
Yeah.
And everybody's going to go nuts and everybody's going to have a great, you know, that's my attitude towards it, is rather than wallow around in all the shit things that have happened, it's, you know, just try and remember that this is probably in as good a position as a species as we've ever been in. So it's not too bad, you know. We're doing okay. There's nothing wrong with a little reset maybe from time to time.
No, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good positive way to look at it. Do you know Frank Turner?
Yeah. I don't know him well. I've played with him a couple of times a long time ago, but I certainly know of him. Yeah, he's a
cool
cracking
dude.
Guy, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. He's somebody that really did, he was full on grassroots all the way up from the bottom, you know.
Yeah.
He did something like 1,000 shows in a year or something like that. Just relentless, absolutely relentless.
That's funny.
Go ahead. I was just going to say he deserves all the acclaim he's ever got, you know. He's worked his ass off, you know.
Yeah, he's fucking great too.
Yeah, you had him on the show, didn't
I
you?
Had him on the show, but it's weird cuz I saw him do basically three shows. I mean, like a record store show, a couple of radio things, and then his gig that night. So that's right, how you do 1,000 gigs in a year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great performer, man. I hope that you're able to come to America at some point soon. I'd love to meet you. I'd love to see the band, man. I bet it's fucking electrifying.
Yeah. Oh, it's good fun, man. It's a lot of energy goes on that stage. Yeah, well, you know, we're hoping to as well. You know, America's one of the places that we were really hoping to get to last year. You know, we had a few plans. I think South by Southwest might have even been on the cards, but when it happens, it will happen. You know, you'll know about it. We'll try and arrive nice and loudly.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Dude, it's been really great talking to you. You're an amazing songwriter. Maverick Thinker is such a great record. People can find you guys at williamtheconqueror.net. Also, that's where you can find the podcast.
That's right. Yeah, it's all there now. Seasons 1 and 2. It's all up. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the book of the podcast will be out sometime later. I've got it here. That's coming out later in the year.
Oh, awesome!
So here's a book as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
full on, man. We're full onslaught. William the Conqueror onslaught.
Onslaught. Yeah, man. Well, I will. I'm about to go walk 5.5 miles to keep up my health. And
good on you.
And
good
I'll be listening to it on that.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, awesome. Rory. It's been really nice meeting you.
Yeah, you too, dude. Yeah, take care of yourself.
You too, my man.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Home from your imagination. You had a ticket long before you had a destination.
Don't take my word for it. Just say you'll do your bit. What a fantastic conversation with Rory Joseph from the UK trio William the Conqueror. Their brand new album out on vinyl and CD, as well as all the digital platforms. It's called Maverick Thinker. You can find them at williamtheconqueror.net. Great conversation, man. What a cool dude. I hope maybe someday we can meet in person. Hey, gang, don't forget, while you're out there checking out williamtheconqueror.net, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you subscribe on podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Stitcher, or the various other ones, platforms. Still putting out 3 shows a week. They're kind of trickling out at this point, aren't they? And then we're going to go back to the two show a week format for April. And also, I think I'm bringing back the From the Vault series. Maybe of a couple of weeks, I'll drop an oldie, but a goodie, if you know what I mean. Any word on the vaccine? All right.
I'm looking it up right now.
It's just not very often there's a girl in my room, except her. You know, sexy lady of the night, 70s sexy lady. What am I talking about? Hey, guys, I want to thank Ruri for talking to me. That was really great. Go check out WilliamTheConqueror.net. Pick up their album, Maverick Thinker, available on vinyl and CD, as well as all of the streaming platforms. You have a great weekend, whatever it is you're doing. I'm going to go play a wedding, still in the complete, in fear. Full fear. Full corona fear. Have a great weekend, whatever you're doing. Let's get down.
Down on your resentment, too many plates to spin, and nowhere to begin. You can dive in at the deep end. You can look the other way. It don't hurt to be reminded. You can only be yourself. Let's get down. Yourself the virgin loaded up and on a mission with 50 live grenades and not a slither of precision. Ah, they rightly laughed, straight away they passed. From one end of the spectrum to a prison in the middle, the execution music played on someone else's broken fiddle. Don't be ungrateful, mind, good luck is hard to find. Where you found it, you can keep it on the steel. It don't hurt to be reminded. It can only be yourself that lets you down. Shadow of an idol of your making, returning to your roots because you failed to bring home any